for over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night, no matter how chaotic your day is. Conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
Hi, I'm Anne Helen Peterson, host of Crooked Media's new podcast, Work Appropriate, a show about all of the bullshit and humor of modern day work culture. I assume that you are very busy sending emails or looking for someone to pick up your shift, so we'll make this quick. Here are three ways to know if my new show, Work Appropriate, is for you. Do you have a manager who expects you to care about work outside of work hours? Do you struggle to know when it's time to ask for a promotion and when it's time to cut bait and get out of there? Do you resist the urge to be petty towards your coworkers at least once a week, if not once a day? If you answered yes to any of these questions, I hope you'll stick around to enjoy a preview of episode one. While you're listening, don't forget to subscribe to Crooked Media's Work Appropriate wherever you get your podcasts. And now, here's Work Appropriate. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. My name is Anne Helen Peterson, and this is Work Appropriate, a new podcast where we answer your questions about the contemporary world of work. So this is an advice show. Maybe you have a question about how to reduce the number of meetings that are clogging your calendar, or maybe you're wondering whether or not it's actually time to quit your job, or maybe you're just trying to decide if it's okay to donate that hideous fleece vest you got as a work gift. Nothing is too weird, too personal, or too hard. Because even if I don't have the answer, there's a good chance my guest host will. Every week, I'll be joined by a new co-host with real expertise to guide us through these questions. Because the world of work is super complicated, often bizarre, never unexciting, and we have so much to talk about. I'm not someone who has ever been really interested in the history of work. Like, I've never taken a business class or even like an econ class. I don't have an MBA. I was a mathlete in high school, just like a stone cold nerd. And I then became an academic in film studies, film and media studies, and then I became a journalist. But when you look at those fields, you know, they have some of the shittiest work cultures out there. Academia and journalism, just garbage work culture. So I think I learned really early that any time that I felt like I was working all the time, that was fantastic. And any time that I felt like I was resting, that was horrible. And I just had this terrible, truly toxic relationship with work. Like, I remember working one day on Christmas and being like, this is really great. Like, I was writing a dissertation or writing an article and being like, Christmas, great day to work. No one's on the internet, can totally get things done. And I'm trying to understand now, like, how I internalized that work culture. Why did I think working on the weekends, even though no one, not my boss, no one told me that I should be doing that? Why did I think that was so great? And why did I allow, you know, every hobby, every activity, every friendship that was not directly related to work to just die on the vine? So at some point around 2018, I realized that I was experiencing something. Like, I just couldn't work the way that I had before. And my coping strategy for that was to try and write an article about it. And that article turned into an article about burnout and about millennial burnout in particular. And it's a burnout book, but really, it's a book about work. And since then, I've continued to think about the history of work, how work got to this particular place in our lives, and what we actually mean when we say things like work culture or any of the other words that get bandied about in terms of how we work, where we work, why we work. So even though I don't have this background in business, I have spent a lot of time thinking and talking about work. And during that process, I have accumulated this long list of people, experts, who do have really interesting things to say, who do have things like LinkedIn optimization tips, but who more importantly are really equipped to give us advice on how to think about the nitty-gritty components of our work days, but also these larger questions about where should work be in our lives? Why does work matter? Because the way we relate to our jobs, for many of us, it's the way we relate to our entire lives. It really matters. For this first episode, I want to start with something really universal, and that's big office feelings. I mean, ultimately at work, we all deal with people, and people bring up feelings. So I wanted to bring on someone who I always go to for these types of big feeling questions.
My name is Josh Gondelman. I am a television writer, often a stand-up comedian. I am a Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist, and I'm currently kind of like between full-time gigs, I think. I mean, my friend Dan Crone has this great stand-up joke about like, I'm between girlfriends, assuming I ever get another girlfriend, and that's how I feel about jobs. But I was the head writer at Desus and Marrow. I was there for all the seasons at Showtime and was the head writer for the fourth season that concluded recently and abruptly.
Josh is truly one of the funniest people I know. He knows a lot about what it means to work in a writer's room and to be a boss in a writer's room, but he's also incredibly thoughtful and kind, just generous and an empathetic thinker, which is why I wanted to have him on the pod today.
So I'm trying to let myself off the hook a little bit now because I'm really trying to like give myself a little space to think, and I know that I will compulsively take on work. That's like a characteristic, a longstanding characteristic of my personality.
Same.
Is that like,
same.
Yes, people will ask me to do things and I'll be like, oh, that sounds really fun, I'll do it. Or I'll see an opportunity and I'll dive at it and not think about like how that affects the overall kind of mosaic of my schedule. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to really work on stuff that I think is fun and productive, but also say no to enough things that I like have space in my day to like not only like read books and catch up with friends, which I haven't had as much time to do until recently, but also to like think about my own work and career in the long term and try to be like a little more self-directed about where I want to go rather than just like knocking on every door until one opens. Because I think hopefully I'm at a point that I can chart my own course a little bit more than like the last time I was actively looking for a job and didn't have one.
Part of why I wanted you to come on the show today is because I think a lot of people, sometimes our tendency is to really always go for all of our worst scenarios and our worst experiences and our worst case understandings of how things could go. And I think that you have this energy and this outlook on the world of like, what if it went really well? Like, what if it went in a way that we would all look back with admiration and appreciation? What if that's the way things go?
I mean, I do feel I've like had some real good luck professionally. And I don't ever want to come off like a guy that's like, yeah, I'm like a straight, white, cisgendered, able-bodied
yes.
man, and all worked
no.
out for me. So like, what are you complaining about? But I do think that it is like, when things go well, it is like a nice thing you can do is to be like an ambassador of gratitude and optimism, in addition to like equity and equality and those kind of broader help and not pulling the ladder up behind you. But I do think like, it is kind of a service to be like, hey, sometimes things are good and that's like, okay.
Yeah. And I mean, you have a regular feature on, I don't know if you'd call it a feature, a thing that you do on Twitter from time to time. That's like, I'm here for 10 minutes for
yeah.
a pep talk.
Yes.
Just to strangers, right?
Yeah. And I think a lot of them are professional. It's like, I have this job interview and I'm really nervous.
Yeah.
And that's like a big one that I get when I do the pep talks. Because sometimes people are just like, hit me. And I just have to like come up with something encouraging to say. Generally, I'll go to their profile or whatever. And then other times they'll have something more specific. And it's a lot of job interview nerves. And I
yeah.
think like that is kind of like, look, go in knowing that they asked you to come in. You didn't trick them. So unless you did, in which case maybe yeah. be a little nervous, or you're so good at lying, just like keep on keeping on, you know? But if I think generally, like, they asked you to come in, be you, and if that doesn't work out, it's because you're not a good match with the people that are there, or they're not a good match for who you are, rather than the fact that, like, you aren't enough. I think, like, it's not really about you is such a helpful thing to think about sometimes, especially, yeah. Like, I work primarily in, like, entertainment, and there's so many, you know, they could, you can walk into an audition, and they can just be like, nah, no beards, you know, and you're like, man, I really thought I did a good job. And they're like, nope, we like a guy whose whole chin we can see. And it's like, okay, sure. And they might never tell you that. You just have to know that you had the wrong face.
So this helps explain a little bit about why you agreed to go on and participate in this show, answering questions from people you've never met in jobs very different than your own.
Yeah, I'm very arrogant. That's one part. But I do have a lot of, like, for someone who is, like, at the moment predominantly doing, like, a little freelance stuff, a lot of stand-up, I do feel like I have a bunch of varied work experiences in, like, classrooms and offices and, like, non-traditional workplaces like comedy clubs. So I do feel like I do work. I promise I have jobs. I'm a professional at something.
I promise I have worked at jobs in
the past. I have worked.
And have advice to give other people who also work in jobs. Same. Yeah. This is how I feel. So we've pulled together a few questions about this theme of big office feelings. And the first is from someone named Stephanie. Mm-hmm. And it brought up some memories for me. But we're going to have her read it here.
I always find the end of the year or anniversary gift a bit of a slap in the face. I'd rather just get the money you allocated per person for the said gift in my paycheck. I know it's supposed to be a nice gesture, but usually it's something that just collects dust or I throw away immediately. Do others feel this way? Are these tokens of appreciation actually good for workplace culture and I'm the anomaly?
Josh, before you answer, I want to know what's the weirdest or worst or maybe best gift that you've ever gotten from work.
Oh, I got sweatpants one year from a job, a sweatpants sweatshirt. And the sweatshirt, totally pleasant and wearable. I like it a lot. The sweatpants, they were like, what size are you? I said large. I could have gone medium. I've been going medium since then with sweatpants, but they are for the biggest person who's ever lived. Like, they're for Shaquille O'Neal. They're Shaq-sized sweatpants. And I'm just like, well, I feel bad throwing them away, like this letter writer, advice asker. But I also have no use for them. I guess, like, if I went camping, I could sleep under them. But it is, like, truly a useless garment. Nobody I know is big enough to wear these sweatpants.
Well, and I love, too, like, the idea of you're like, okay, if I donate this and then it somehow ends up at Goodwill or a thrift shop or whatever, who wants these Shaq-sized sweatpants embroidered with the name of my company?
Yes.
I used to work at BuzzFeed News, and BuzzFeed is interesting in that it starts, were as like an upstart digital journalism site that was also a startup, right? Mm-hmm. So it has, like, I think some of the good and bad bits of culture of both. And the lavish Christmas present was one of those things. So every year we would get, like, I don't know, 8 to 10 pieces of BuzzFeed swag. And we're talking about hoodies, sweatpants, socks, multiple hats, you know, just like piles, and you would accumulate these piles of BuzzFeed clothing. But it was somewhat like what you were saying, that, like, you kind of wore it like the team sweatshirt, and there was this idea of, like, you're on the team if you're wearing this. When, you know, a lot of my younger colleagues, especially people in their first couple years out of college, they were barely getting paid enough to survive in New York. So, you know, one of the reasons that they wore their BuzzFeed things every day was because it was a free sweatshirt, right?
Yes.
And also one of the reasons why they ate a lot of the free food that we had in the office was because that made it slightly more affordable to live in New York City on $40,000 a year, which is, like, what some of the early employees made. The other thing that we received when there were, like, rumblings of the beginnings of the what would become the unionization drive is everyone in the company received an Apple Watch, the first Apple Watch.
Wow.
Which, like, you know, that's a big deal. Like, it's hard to be like, screw this, I'm getting an Apple Watch. And some people definitely resold it as soon as they got it.
Yeah.
But it also felt like bribery.
Yeah, right? Definitely.
Like, instead of coming together to push for, like, fair pay and severance, mm-hmm. if they laid us off, it's like, take this Apple Watch and be happy with it.
I feel like, though, when it's a company like that, like, this isn't the mob, right? You can take the bribe and agitate for the other things. And I think that's not unethical, right? If you're like a politician and you take a bribe and you don't do the thing, it's like, well, that's not, come on, that's not the deal. But with a company, it's like, no, you got to bribe me better. Like, that is the deal.
Right. And in hindsight, I should have sold the Apple Watch. And instead, because I was like angry about the Apple Watch, but then also felt like it's weird to resell it, I didn't do anything with it, and now I have an unopened box for an Apple Watch, first generation Apple Watch, and it's worth, I think, 70 cents.
Wow. Well, I think anything that you can flip is a better gift than something you can't. Like, if you get like a really, really nice winter jacket, but it has like big company branding on it, that's not as nice as just the winter jacket, right? Because at the very least, you can turn a profit on that. And it's like they spent money on it, and it's not just in the glorification of the company. It's like actually a nice, it's like, here, this is a thing conceivably you could want. And as long as it can't be like super traced back to you, you know, it's not like a one of one.
Yeah. So like to answer our question, I think that it's really okay to feel angry and resentful about these presents, particularly if they feel unuseful and it feels like the company's way of deflecting from cost of living increases, mm-hmm. things that would actually make work life easier on an everyday basis. And it just feels, it does feel like a bribe.
Yeah. If it's not something that would be a good gift from like a regular person, it's not a good gift from the company. And in fact, even if it would be a good gift from a regular person, you're not like obligated to feel gratitude for it,
yes.
because it's coming from your employer and they don't have to do it. I think like absolutely going back to what you said, you can feel any kind of way about it. You are not a bad person for being like, well, this costs like $150 or like this cost $50. You know, you don't have to like feel like you're licking a gift horse in the mouth. You can just be like, this horse is a dickhead. I don't care.
Right. And also use that as an opportunity to think about like, oh, well, maybe this is indicative of much larger issues at our company. And that I think is the moments when it really pisses people off, because it's a symbol, right? It's like when my stepmom would give me Black Hills Gold for presents when I was growing up. Like, I hated jewelry, and mm-hmm. I especially hated Black Hills Gold. Anyone from like the Mountain West will know what Black Hills Gold is. And to me, it wasn't about the actual jewelry. Like, people like Black Hills Gold for various reasons. It was indicative of the fact that she didn't know me or know what I wanted.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Totally.
Our next question is about the whole big feelings process of changing a workplace's culture. So here is the question from Lisa.
I started a new job recently. I love this job. I love the work. I love my coworkers. I just love everything about it. My boss and I manage our organization staff, which is maybe 50 people. My boss hired me. She and I get along great. She's also relatively new to the organization. Before I arrived, my boss started to establish a detail-oriented and high-performance-oriented culture, which was a bit of a change. I want more help thinking about how to make sure the team feels like we have their backs. I want the team to feel like they can tell us what's going on. I want them to come to us with problems. And then I also want to maintain this detail-oriented and performance-oriented culture. These are not mutually exclusive, and I know that, but sometimes they can feel like they're going in opposite directions. For example, we can get a lot of haranguing when we give input on something or ask for rework. So I want the team to tell us if we're like completely missing something, but also start to adjust their expectations that this is customary. I also have truly felt at some points like this organization can be a bit resistant to change, like lots of people can. But as a result, I want to be open. And then also, I think at some stage, we might just have to deliver tough messages. Mostly, I think this is just going to take time and attention and communication. And I'm curious if you have any reactions or advice on how to navigate this balance. I want the team to trust us. I want to feel like we're all in this together. And I also really want to do great work.
All right. This is a hard one, I think. But also, I think that, Josh, like, I wonder if you have some experience or thoughts about how you have pushed a team, like your team, to deliver excellent work when maybe they haven't been pushed like that in quite the same way before.
I think that one thing that is always helpful when you're talking about this, because this is something that did not come up in the question, and I wonder if it's because it's taken as a given, is that I think if you have to give hard notes to people or hard messages, being equally effusive about the stuff that they're doing well, and specifically the stuff that comes from their specific experience and taste and ability, being like equally encouraging and nurturing of that, I think is where I would start. And not that it's like a bad question to have left that out, but I do think like focusing on that, right? Giving the like encouragement and like enthusiasm for people's good work, in addition to like the kind of growth opportunities, as you'd say, in a performance review, is like really important, because like, and it can feel like it's going by the wayside because you're like, oh, I don't have to worry about that. And it's like, well, the person who's doing it and is receiving criticism is worried about that. So yeah, that's like totally my first thing for sure.
Yeah, I think one thing that we sometimes forget is that a lot of people are really scared at all times about losing their jobs, right? And they feel like they're doing an adequate job. And so the more that you can emphasize, like, you were doing a great job as described, we're trying to figure out how to do more with this.
Yeah. When you're trying to foster, especially like diversity and diverse experiences and opinions of a staff, I think like valuing what they bring to the table and not just like using people as data and then kind of puppeting them to make things come out the way you want them to come out,
right,
is like a really valuable thing to do. Letting people do things in an excellent way that is not the way you would do them is, I think, like really like high tier management that is really hard, because it's hard to trust like, well, I wouldn't do it this way, but it's but this is like a really cool, thrilling way that this turned out.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes it makes me think of like how we have this expectation that everyone figures out a math problem the same way. Mm-hmm. Remember how you used to have to like show your work?
Yeah.
And if you didn't do it the way that you were instructed, then there would be points off for not following the order of operations.
Yeah.
A lot of people's minds work really differently
than
the one way that we teach. And if you empower someone to say, if you can figure out how you get to this answer, or if you can figure out how you get to excellent work, like whatever these reports are, like what the workflow is, or what the way that you double or triple check things are. Like, if you figure out your own system, and if you empower someone to figure that out for themselves and praise them and give them the security to figure that out, then they are going to feel much more like it's their project. It's their excellence.
Right. And they're not doing a karaoke version of what you would do. And because I think that is really demoralizing to feel like, oh, I was brought in because I have these skills, and what I'm a cover band now for someone else's point of view. I will also say, building in expectations at the beginning, right, of like, this is what we're trying to get to, and building in if there's going to be rework, people knowing that ahead of time. I think it is such a bummer when you're like, I've knocked this out of the park, and then someone else is like, oh, actually, we need to like totally redo this part with these other expectations in mind. And I think like knowing that that's possible coming into it, and like what might result in that other than like unsatisfactory work, is really helpful. So like going, oh, it might take the first draft to know what we want in the final draft, and that's part of it. And like, thank you for your effort getting us to this point, because this is really spectacular and really clarifying. Or going, look, this is what we're shooting for, we didn't quite hit it, so let's try it again. And I think like, it is knowing that multiple revisions are part of it, and knowing that like what you're shooting for as close to what the final product is from the beginning is really helpful. Cause I think some of the most like, I've been at jobs is when I did something and then you hear like after the fact, like, this is great, you worked so hard on it, actually, we're going in a totally different direction, and now you have to do that. And it's like, you couldn't have decided that 3 days ago before I started. And I think those kind of conversations are really difficult, and being really mindful of your staff's investment and time is really important.
Yeah, that to me speaks to disrespect of someone's time.
Yeah,
right? Right,
because you need the job done. Offices are made of people. So it's not, you're not dealing with a bunch of Sims or like robots that you can like reprogram, and nor should you be. And I think to think of it as like, it's their whole day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like it's a bummer to like go into work knowing that like, oh, I could have just not come in Monday through Wednesday, and then you could have just given me this assignment on Thursday.
Like, right. If you would have just equipped me to do it right the first time, I would have done it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that creates like a resentment cycle that's really hard to pull out of.
People like to feel appreciated for specifically their hard work and what they do well, rather than just like, gold star, you're a good cog, you know?
Right. And to feel seen in the work that they've put in. To see that appreciated.
And there are some times where I've been like, hey, I think these two sections are like equivalently good, but maybe a little duplicative. And if you have one that you prefer, I trust your judgment.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like giving people agency. And again, not just feeling like you're shoving your hand up their butt I guess a less gross way is like ratatouille-ing them to the result that you want, right? Like I really think that the more you can give people the structure to succeed, to set their expectations for what you want as like clearly as you can, and then trust their expertise, the better an experience it is for them. And then conversely, right, if you give them all these expectations and it's too much, if you're just like, do it this way, then it's just like, screw you, you do it. You know what I mean? If you're gonna like stand over my shoulders making pottery like in Ghost, and it's like, no, this isn't a collaborative experience, this is you being too controlling. So I think it's like that balance is really helpful. I think like kind of to sum up, give people clear expectations of what you want from them, right? So that they know what the objective is and why there might need to be edits done, right? Or changes made once you see how it turns out. And empower them to do things that showcase their perspective, their expertise, and what they're bringing to the table. And that way, it's less like you're operating your staff like a machine and more like you're empowering them to do their best work rather than a photocopy of your best work.
Perfect. Our last question is from Emily, who seems to feel a responsibility to speak up about her work, but she's also just really freaking tired. So let's hear from her.
I work in advertising right now, and one of the things that I've butted up against in my career is figuring out when I should have a voice at the table and how to create room and space for that as a woman. I thought I would feel more empowered once I got promoted to a director-level position, but recently I've realized that a title alone, or confidence or more, doesn't really create that. So my question is, how do you find the mental and emotional energy to continually advocate for your voice and perspective to be heard? Is it even worth it to try? Or does the fact that you have to push for that space indicate something more broken and toxic about the workplace dynamic?
Well, I think the fact that you do have to push and try is indicative of the fact that there's something wrong with the workplace dynamic. But I think that that's also incredibly common, particularly in any industry that is historically masculinized in some way. And it's also probably in most of these similar workplaces, it's also usually really, really white. So even in industries like nonprofits that are dominated by women, there's a similar feeling about like only white women feeling like they're able to have that space to speak up and that sort of thing, no matter how high they rise in the organization. So I think part of it is just real structural resistance. And it takes a lot of effort to resist or to rework structures when you are the individual. And I think that that's why so many people who are marginalized in whatever way in their particular industry end up burnt out, because in addition to doing their everyday work, right, whatever their job description is, they are also doing this resisting and rewriting and rethinking work all of the time. They have to strategize consistently. How do I make people trust me, grant me the authority that they would automatically give to someone who is a white male in the room or a white person in the room? And then also, how do I make them not think just because of like the tone of my voice, the way that my face looked on Zoom, the way I responded to an email or a Slack, that like that I'm a bitch and that I have too much power, right? It's just an incredible balancing act that I think is really difficult. And I want to just acknowledge that like that is a ton of work. Josh, have you ever worked with anyone that like has spoke up in this way and that you admire how they've handled it?
Yeah, totally. I don't have the same firsthand experience, but I have seen 4 seasons of Mad Men, and then I didn't have cable for a while, so I missed out on the last couple, but that's fine. So I'm an ally. No. One thing that I've seen that is really helpful is like someone who feels this way coming to people that they trust and that they feel are good collaborators and saying like, hey, these are the kinds of things that would be really helpful to me. Especially if you're a person who wants to encourage that kind of like speaking up from all the voices at the table, but there are louder voices than you. Learning how to support those things is really helpful. And I think it's not right that you necessarily have to coach people to be your cheerleaders, but I think that that can be really helpful, is like talking honestly with the people that you trust and feel like you have good relationships with and can go like, you know, I don't feel like there's space for my ideas here. If you could help create that space for me by asking me for my input or seconding something that I say it so it doesn't get scuttled and shouting me out by name instead of just like, I think this, and then taking the credit for it. It's one way, one avenue that I think there are probably people that are really open to doing it. And I will say, if there is no one that is open to doing that because you don't have those relationships with anyone, or if they're like, no, it's too risky for me, that does sound like an incredibly toxic place. Like I'm an over-the-line toxic place rather than like you're describing and a baseline toxic place.
Yeah. Like just modern workplace culture. I think that in an ideal world, that person might be Emily's manager or Emily's mentor at the organization. But most people don't have that ideal situation. And sometimes, if anything, their manager, especially, I've seen this with a lot of women, like, there's a scarcity mindset, right? That like only one woman can be the like powerful woman in the situation. And so I'm going to undercut that other woman, which is incredibly toxic and regressive in so many different ways. But sometimes you can't trust the other woman who's in the room to do that for you. And so I think developing that sort of trust and asking for low-key collaboration that way, to say like, to have someone else in the room that is looking out for moments when, say, you are continuously interrupted.
Yes.
Right? And to have the one who calls bullshit on that person, like who keeps doing the interrupting, to have that be another dude, that is incredibly powerful, right?
Yeah. And coming from a man is sadly helpful. And then when it's on behalf of someone else, I think like redirecting of like, oh, I think Emily had a really good idea about that, rather than just like, what you want to say, right? Which is like, shut the fuck up, I'm talking. And so like, I think that there's a real value in having someone who in the optics of the room, like doesn't have the same skin in the game, is like really helpful, especially when they have like a kind of professional or social standing that you feel like isn't being granted to you fairly.
Yeah, I do think that it would be important. Like, let's say it's you and me in this situation. And I felt this way, that like I really didn't know, or I was exhausted with advocating for myself, but I hadn't told you about this.
Yeah.
And you had noticed it, and like you started coming to my rescue, not in the more subtle way that you were describing, but more in the way that I was talking about like calling people out and be like, you should respect Anne, like that sort of thing. It borders on ickiness because it can feel like
totally
the guy is like trying to protect the woman.
Right.
Like if you were noticing that, the way that I think a great way to handle it would be you to approach me and say like, I've kind of noticed this dynamic. Is this something you're thinking about? Is there a way that I could be helpful?
Yeah, right. What I don't want, right? The goal is for that your ideas and perspective have space, not that like I'm a hero or that like, you know, I'm just like, yeah, I'm such a fucking cool guy. But that it is, you know, to create that space in the way that is most comfortable for you, and that opens up a lane in a way that you feel like you can do your best work, rather than creating like possibly like a self-aggrandizing, self-centering conflict in the room to be like, ah, okay, men, listen up. An ally is talking. And I think that that's, you know, so coming from, if there are listeners that like have that, I think you're so right to like center the experience of the person who you're trying to like throw that alley-oop to rather than center your own experience of like yourself in that meeting.
And I think this extends, you know, we're talking about kind of a doofy male doing that, but it would definitely extend to, I think, any white person who's trying to be kind of like attract attention to themselves as an ally.
Yeah.
Have that conversation with the person that you're trying to make more space for and try to figure out how they would like it to be handled.
Yeah.
The other thing that I would say is that, like, yeah, it's really exhausting. And the one thing, like, you know, our question asks, how do you find the mental and emotional energy to continually advocate for this? Like, is it worth it even to try? And I do think it's worth it because I think that we are still doing that really hard work of resetting expectations and refiguring what power looks and sounds like, all of those different things. So it is worth it, but also we don't have to martyr ourselves on it, right? And it does not have to be like, if I quit this job or if I stop trying to do this 100% of the time altogether, I am failing my gender or my race or whatever.
Right. Like chalk one up for the patriarchy.
Yeah.
I'm I got deficient. Too tired. Yeah. They broke me. Right. And I do think there is that walking that line and figuring out the answer to the question, like, is this place uniquely ill-suited to offering me the kind of input and autonomy and agency that I want? Or is this a place that like there can be strides made? Because you don't want to bang your head against the wall, right?
You want
to find a softer wall that you can kind of Kool-Aid man or woman through it. Why hasn't there been a Kool-Aid woman? Now I'm like just fully
just like spiraling. This is a joke that is like so particular to like a certain segment.
Yeah. That's
group.
True.
Like, we are just like elder millennial.
That's true.
Ourselves. All
yeah.
The
Kool-Aid there. Man was a very central figure for elder millennials. I don't know if he's still doing kind of amateur demolition the way he was back in the day. But that is it, right? Like, I feel like if there was a Kool-Aid woman who was like, oh, yeah, and it's like, I'm leaning in, and they'd be like, oh, this lady, she stinks. She's just breaking down our house.
Whereas right, or she like, would have to, like, become, like, evil Kool-Aid woman, right? Like it would be like Ursula. And
yes, that's exactly
that
where I went to, which is also the very same generation of, like, cultural reference in Touchstone.
All right, so in summary, this is a normal feeling because this is how workplace culture is often structured. You don't have to martyr yourself in order to fix it. It is not your personal responsibility to fix all of these problems. And it might just be organizational. And the only solution is to quit and find another organization that is trying to change some of these norms or another industry, sadly. But then also that there are ways that you can find people who are willing to play on the same team as you, right? Like there are people who also want the culture to be different. And so how can you seek out and trust those people to try to figure out strategies to do that moving forward? Do you have anything to add there? Was I perfect?
As a man, I agree. I feel like this is not my place to be like, yeah, and another thing. But I think that was a great answer. And it's so tricky. It's so hard.
Yeah.
Because you're up against culture, right? You're not just up against like one guy or a room full of guys or like a one company's stodginess. You're up against like the expectations of society.
Yeah. You're up against like norms that have taken centuries to ossify around how we think about women in authority.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
That's a lot.
And I think what you said about like, whatever works for you is the right thing. You're not like an ambassador for everyone.
Yep. Josh, I am so grateful that you took the time to come on this show today. Not just because you made me laugh like at least 17 different times, but also because you are a person who takes feelings seriously. And I really love that.
Thank you. That's very kind. I really appreciate that compliment. It means a lot to me.
It was a total pleasure to have you today, and I would love to have you back on anytime to talk about the problems of people you've never met in situations
love
that
it.
You've never been in.
Terrific. I feel Love doing it. Love working with you. We'll come back anytime. I have a lot of unstructured time these days.
Thanks so much for listening to the first episode of Work Appropriate. I'm so excited this is happening. And if you have a workplace quandary you want help figuring out, get in touch. You can find submission guidelines at workappropriate.com or send a voice memo with your question to workappropriate@crooked.com. Some of the episodes we're working on involve managing your time and energy as a freelancer, or the weird stuff that happens when you're starting a new job, or what to do when the work you love is grinding you into a pulp. Work Appropriate is a Crooked Media production. I'm Anne Helen Peterson, your host. Our executive producers are Kendra James and Sandy Gerard. Melody Rowell is our producer and editor. Allison Falzetta is our development producer. Music is composed by Chanel Critchlow. Additional production support by Ari Schwartz. And special thanks to Katie Long and Sarah Geismer. You can follow me on Twitter at Anne Helen or on Instagram at Anne Helen Peterson. You can sign up for my newsletter at annehelen.substack.com. And meet me back here next week as we try to get to the root of why modern workplace culture is so hostile to parents. You just heard the first episode of my new show, Work Appropriate. If you're interested in hearing more, subscribe now to Work Appropriate wherever you get your podcasts.